between World War I and World War II and take a look at American foreign policy during that period. I think a lot of people who have some awareness of American history look at this period as being a period of isolationism. I really think to call this period isolationistic is not quite accurate, because I don't think on the world scene we really were that isolated. Rather, I think one might call it a period of independent internationalism. Something like that. I think that capitalizes it better. Very independent, but still we're on the international scene. True enough, we were not in the League of Nations, we saw that. And by March of 1921, on the American political scene, the whole question of should we be in the League of Nations or not at the official level was a political discussion that was passé. The Americans had moved beyond that. But to say that we were not involved at all in the League of Nations isn't true, because we had observers over at where the League of Nations met throughout the 1920s. And they were pretty active participants in a lot of the discussions that went on, even though they didn't have the vote. So I don't think it's accurate to say in that sense we were isolationistic. I don't think it's true. Then, during this period, American enterprise expands mightily across the seas, and American investment across the seas as well. So in that sense, we're very involved. Diplomatically, we're involved in a lot of disarmament discussions during that decade. Above all, an attempt to try to stabilize the political situation in the Orient. It's got to do with China and Japan primarily. And then finally, I think under the presidency of Herbert Hoover, he really, more than anybody else, laid the groundwork for Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, as it was called, with regard to Latin and Central America. Hoover really had a big start in that program. So a new approach to Latin America. One of the realities in the immediate post-World War I period is that the United States emerged from the war as a great world power. So we emerge now for the first time as a great creditor nation. We're not a debtor nation anymore. That means our balance of trade is vastly in favor of the United States. So what we were actually doing is siphoning gold off the world market and piling it up in the United States. So there are some historians who say that what the United States did during the 20s is was active on the world scene only in a certain sense, but kind of abdicated certain areas of responsibility that we should have taken. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I think that's subject to interpretation. In a certain sense, maybe not be involved at a certain level officially wasn't all so bad, because we weren't involved in the Treaty of Versailles, which certainly had all kinds of problems associated with it. We didn't agree to the dividing up of empires around the world. We weren't involved in that in an official sense. So there were certain virtues, I think, in a kind of retreat from world involvement at a certain level. We didn't get involved in war in the 1920s. Other ways, I think we were very involved. For example, trying to create climate around the world that would be favorable for American business. Climate favorable. And this is not naked imperialism, nor is it the kind of dollar diplomacy you had under President Taft. try to create places where it's good for America to invest, American business people to go. Then, another thing in this period is we did maintain the peace, and it was the United States that took an active role in trying to do it. And I'll give you some examples of this. And one reason why you want to maintain the peace is, in the context of the 20s, you see war as a disruptor of the business, a climate. You maintain peace to maintain climates favorable for business. That makes good sense. Another part of our foreign policy in the 20s, and this is kind of building block for post-World War II, is contained the Bolshevik Revolution, the Red Revolution in Russia. And we do this by non-recognition of Soviet Russia. We don't recognize Russia until Roosevelt comes along. And actually, the Bolshevik Revolution didn't spread much during that period. Well, okay, so that's just a generalized approach to foreign policy in the 20s. Now some specifics. Early in the decade, 1921, what the United States did is really staged a rather bold, imaginative, and timely stroke in foreign policy to try to avert the arms race, above all in the building of great navies. So what happens is we call the Washington Naval Conference. So the Washington Naval Conference meets in Washington, D.C. So after World War I, the great powers were continuing to build navies, big navies. So there's a naval race going on. Secretary of State Hughes and Secretary of the Treasury Mellon plus Secretary of Commerce Hoover all agreed that was foolish to be spending all this money on building these big ships, battleships, heavy cruisers, that kind of thing. So at the conference, the Secretary of State Hughes strikes immediately and proposes a formula of 5-5-3-1-7-5-1-7-5. What that meant is 5-5 would be Britain and the United States, 3 would be Japan, 1-7-5 would be France and Italy, and that they would set up a ratio of naval tonnage in relationship to one another on that basis, 5-5-3-1-7-5-1-7-5. And they would scrap any tonnage that didn't meet that ratio. Well, they figured that 5 would be about 900,000 tons of battleship or cruiser and destroyer. So, and basically capital ships is what they're concentrating on. That's the battleship and the cruiser. And they agreed to this. So what happens is the naval race stops, at least in the early 20s. Any of you know who Billy Mitchell is? Does that... No relationship to Billy Mitchell. Interesting. Well, Billy Mitchell is the fella who said battleships and cruisers are passe, because what can you do? You can take an airplane and sink them. And this is where you have the beginning of thinking about developing a ship that will eventually develop into the aircraft carrier. Okay? The key naval vessel in World War II is not the battleship, but the aircraft carrier. Billy Mitchell is going to be court-martialed for saying this. Right? It's a famous case of the 20s. But anyhow, what Billy Mitchell did then to prove his point is... sank some of these battleships and cruisers to prove that the airplane can do this, to bring bring our tonnage down to the proper level. So, the armaments race is stopped. Well, France then proposed that you have the same thing, a ratio for armies, and they wanted a standing army of 2 million people. Well, already at this point, the United States Army was at 200,000, and that's all we wanted. So we didn't want to go into this kind of an agreement with regard to armies, so that never got any place. But anyhow, so we actually scrapped about 800,000 tons of American naval vessels during this period. Then in the Orient, and you can begin to see the shaping of tensions, well, not the beginning, the continuation of the shaping of tensions between the United States and Japan that's eventually going to lead to World War II. The key point of tension in the Far East was China. China during this period. China still hadn't recovered from its revolution early in the century, 1911. And China was struggling between, already at this point, Mao Zedong and the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek. We saw where early in the century various European powers, along with Japan and the United States, were trying to carve out spheres of influence in China. So what we're going to try to do is make agreements between powers that are interested in Asia, to make agreements with one another, to respect one another's rights out there. So this is the Nine Power Treaty. It's what it's called, the Nine Power Treaty. That would be Britain, Japan, the United States, France, Portugal, Holland, the various countries that would have real estate and empire out in Asia. And so they make an agreement with one another that they're going to respect one another's rights out in Asia. And then the other part was to guarantee the integrity of China in the face of the problem of the weakness of China, so that one country cannot carve it up at the expense of another country, that kind of thing. So maintain the territorial integrity of China. And another key aim of that was to keep the Bolsheviks out, that'd be Russia out of China, that'd be from Manchuria northward. Okay, and then the agreement that they're going to consult with one another if trouble breaks out. Of course, trouble will break out early in the 30s when the Japanese take over Manchuria. Well, 1927, you have what is known as the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Kellogg is the American, and Briand is the Frenchman. By the way, Kellogg Boulevard downtown St. Paul is named after him. Kellogg Boulevard, he's a St. Paulite. Okay? Kellogg and Briand, what this was is an attempt to kind of buttress the League of Nations by having the countries of the world, and finally they had 60-some countries sign this, to outlaw war. Now that may sound us as kind of visionary and meaningless, but to outlaw war as a source of solving disputes. The notion being that if you have a dispute, you will bring your dispute to arbitration rather than going to war with one another. Well, of course, not going to last very long, but noble effort. Then something else that's closely involved with one another is a result of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, now the Treaty of Versailles, part of the Treaty of Versailles was the War Guilt Clause, so the Germans had to sign it. And when they sign it, they're signing one of the clauses that say they're guilty for having started World War I, which historically is just afraid that if they don't sign it, the war will continue, and then there'll be civil war in Germany, and it'll lead to a Bolshevik or a Red Revolution. So they signed War Guilt Clause. Well, since they're guilty, and they signed it, means they admit it, they've got to pay war reparations. Or they have to pay their enemies money for the guilt that they have for having caused the war. Okay, and the bill was about $25 billion. Now, the other side of this problem is war debts. War debts are money that our allies owe to us. So you've got war debts and war reparations. Now what happened early on is the Germans obviously were not able to pay this. So they default on their debts. As a result of this, our allies say that they cannot pay us war debts because they're not getting war reparations from Germany. Well, so what's going to happen? France and Britain default. Say we're not getting our war reparations. So what the United States did in both 1924 and 1928 is in each one of these years, first we come with the Dawes Plan, which scaled down the payments. And then 4 years later, in 1928, we scale them down some more. That's the Young Plan. So the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan. Scaling down war reparations. See, then what we do is the United States makes loans to the Germans so that they can make their scaled back payments of war reparations to our former allies, and then our former allies pay us war debt, and then we make loans to the Germans, and around it goes. Okay? So we tend to scale it back. Now the French said, and I think there was a certain truth to what they said, is basically we French don't owe you Americans anything, because your contribution to the war should be the financial contribution. Because your contribution in terms of men and blood was so late in the war that you should consider this to be your payment for the war. Well, President Coolidge said quite simply, they hired the money, didn't they? This is a direct quote. They hired the money, didn't they? Well, I think we learned from this. After World War II, rather than demanding from our allies during the war, paying back for what we gave them during the war, what did we actually do? We gave them Marshall Plan in addition. Right? So I think we learned that really I think the French were right. But anyhow, what's going to happen is when the crash comes, and then the depression, and there's a depression in the whole Western world, is under President Hoover, shortly before he leaves the presidency, he calls a moratorium on the payment of all war debts and war reparations. And that's what happened. So the whole business stops, war debts, war reparations, in the early 1930s. There's one country that continues paying the United States. You know which country that is? Huh?
Nope.
Finland. Little Finland. As a result of this, the American people knew this. When Russia attacked Finland in 1939 in the Winter War, maybe some of you aren't even aware of that. In the Winter War, Stalin, after the Russian-German pact between Ribbentrop and Molotov, the big bear and the German eagle. Stalin was scared to death, so he wants to kind of they attacked Finland to try to get some real estate there in the Gulf of Finland. And the American people really were very supportive of the Finns. And by the way, they kept back the Russian army that whole darn winter, which really showed you the results of Stalin having wiped out a good share of the Russian officer corps in the purges in 38 and 39. Some of you were aware of that, chapter. A lot of fascinating history back there. You know, the Americans had a love affair with the Finns. They paid. Well, so be it. As I say, there were a lot of arbitration agreements that we had with 20 nations that if we have a particular problem with them, we're not going to fight about it. We're going to arbitrate it. We'll submit our differences to the world court and let the world court make a decision, and we'll see at peace. Well, okay, a final footnote to all of this would be Latin America. One of the great revolutions of the 20th century is the Mexican Revolution. The Mexican Revolution of, in the teens of this century. But this has got spillover into the 20s. In the 20s, the Mexicans nationalized their oil. And they suggested that they were not going to pay us for the expropriated American oil field where Americans had invested. So what happens is President Coolidge sends down to Mexico as the American ambassador a man by the name of Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W. Now, do any of you know who his daughter was? His daughter married Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy. You know who he is, don't you? Lindbergh? First flew across the Atlantic to Paris alone. Charles Lindbergh. So, in other words, then, he's the grandfather of the child of Lindbergh, who was kidnapped and murdered by Hauptmann, one of the famous murder cases of this period. But anyhow, what Murrow did is negotiated with the Mexicans, the rather than a gung-ho American kind of macho approach to Latin America, a new kind of soft approach to Latin America, where our differences with Mexico were settled. Well, you remember how under Woodrow Wilson, we had really made war against Pancho Villa in Mexico. You're not going to do this. So it's a much softer approach. Kind of good neighbor policy beginning here. As far as Colombia is concerned, see, Teddy Roosevelt now was safely dead, so we paid Colombia a certain amount of money, $25 million, for having really triggered the independence of Panama from Colombia when the Panama Canal was being built. We engineered that, so we've got a guilty conscience and give him some money. Well, that's a new, softer approach. Nicaragua, where we always send in Marines whenever they got in trouble, this time we didn't do that. They had a problem there, so we negotiate with them to settle the problem rather than sending in the Marines. So, in a real sense, then, under Herbert Hoover, you got the beginning of the pay